Progressive Radio Network.
Together now. This is Eleanor LeCain. We continue our treasure hunt for solutions. Today we're talking about solutions to the climate crisis. We know our climate is changing from warming temperatures to wildfires to more frequent and fierce hurricanes. We know that climate change is due in large measure to greenhouse gases, including carbon, being released in the atmosphere, particularly from the burning of fossil fuels like coal and oil. What's less known is what are the solutions to the climate crisis. Our guest today has a plan on what we can do to deal with the climate crisis. Dr. Arjun Makhijani is a scientist who has created a path forward for us. We spoke with him a few years ago about his book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. It was the first analysis of a transition to a U.S. economy based completely on renewable energy without any fossil fuels or nuclear power. He has continued on that path and now written a new book that shows how one state, Maryland, can respond to the climate crisis. The book is called Prosperous Renewable Maryland, Roadmap for a Healthy, Economical, and Equitable Energy Future. His book provides a model for what we could do nationally. Dr. Makhijani earned a Ph.D. in nuclear fusion in electrical engineering from the University of California, Berkeley, and he's the founder of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. He's been a friend and a colleague of mine for many years. Dr. Makhijani, welcome back to All Together Now.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. It's good to be back.
Yeah, so maybe you can start by explaining to our listeners, why did you write this new book about a roadmap for Maryland in dealing with the climate crisis?
Yeah, when we discussed my earlier book, this Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, the state of renewable energy development in the United States was really not very advanced, except for wind energy. It was still expensive. The state of storage was also very difficult. At that time, in my assessment, a very, very massive effort for research and development would be needed. It could be done, I concluded, but it would not be easy. And it would be maybe 2050 or even 2060 by the time we could have, say, a really renewable energy system. Between 2007 and about 2014 or 15, the renewable energy, especially on the electricity side, advanced so fast, I was very skeptical that solar energy, for instance, could be $1 a watt, which was a goal set by Secretary of Energy Chu. He was Obama's first Secretary of Energy. I was very skeptical. I thought it's too ambitious, too fast, down from $3 or $4. But it was achieved 3 years before the target date of 2020. So, and then my original work did not do an hour-by-hour model. Will the lights really come on when you flip the switch? Will the loads and supply of solar and wind be balanced? How much storage do you actually need? So all of these questions demanded answers. and how much will it cost? Will we be able to really afford it? Which were much more difficult of answering when I wrote my first book. But now it's clear it will be more affordable to do renewable energy, efficiency, storage, and a modern smart grid than staying on business as usual. We're at a very hopeful stage if we have the guts to act.
Oh, I love that. It sounds like the motto for whoever should be the next president. I love it. So,
you're free to adopt it, Eleanor. Spread the word.
Thank you. I will. So let's just take a little step back. You know, you've really, in many ways, devoted your life to dealing with getting rid of some of the dangers initially of the nuclear energy, and more recently around the climate crisis thing. Could you just say a word for those of us who are listening who might not know much about it? Just why are you dedicating so much of your life to this? How dangerous is global warming, really, and does it matter? Could we ignore it, or what happens if we don't take strong action now?
So what's the nature of this problem? So global warming, you know, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, it doesn't seem like a whole lot. You know, the temperature fluctuates by more than that every day, and certainly from season to season. So we're adding carbon dioxide, methane to the atmosphere and making the world warmer. There's no question about that in my mind, as in the minds of, you know, almost every scientist. But the problem isn't the average temperature change. About 25 years ago, when I started working more intensively on this problem and then, you know, really devoted myself to it for over a decade now, I told a friend, it's not the average temperature that's going to hurt you. It's your head in the oven and feet in the freezer, and the average temperature goes up slightly. The discomfort is head in the oven and feet in the freezer. And we can see the Arctic temperature rises are much greater than the average. This last winter, temperatures in the Arctic were more than 20, 30 degrees above normal. The Arctic ice is melting, and we've got these runaway effects. So Arctic ice melts, the ocean becomes warmer, it absorbs more heat, and it disrupts the circulation patterns over the Arctic, the air circulation. That's why we get these polar vortexes. So now we're warmer on average, but in the winter in Maryland, we can get extreme winds the way we never have. So we get these droughts, floods. Of course, there's always been droughts and floods, but they are much more extreme. In 2017, the damage from extreme climate events in the United States, only the expensive ones, was almost $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And yet we are not taking vigorous action to do our part. And of course, you know, the U.S. is not the only emitter in the world, but it's the second largest emitter. And I think in a way, President Obama showed what could be done if we go in the right direction when he went to China and said, okay, you're a big emitter, can we agree to reverse course and start reducing emissions? And of course, that's not enough. It's just orienting yourself in the right direction. And now we have to sprint to the goal. We don't have a lot of time.
And how much time do we have?
Well, you know, we are already living the bad effects of climate change at 1 degree Celsius, about almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit temperature change on average. This is worse than had been predicted. My formula for this, it'll be worse than you thought and faster than you thought. So it's not that we're not going to see damage. We're already seeing damage. The question is, can we eliminate emissions and then also reverse course? Now we have to find ways to absorb the carbon dioxide we've already emitted. I think we can do it. We can combine healthy energy with healthy soil, and we can talk about that. And I think we need to reverse course now. I think we've got, if you look at the climate models, in the United States and the West, we should be reducing greenhouse gases by 50 to 60% in the next 10 years and 100% in the next 20 to 25 years. So in other words, carbon neutral. And then beyond that, we need to be reducing the CO2 in the atmosphere by absorbing some of what we've already emitted.
Well, that is a challenging course you've laid out for us here, and I would be very nervous about that, except for the fact that I know you also have in your pocket a plan on what we can do about it, which I'm deeply grateful to you for doing that. So, and I do get concerned sometimes about environmentalists or people coming out talking about climate change, getting everybody very scared, because it is scary. And I was just listening to some polling that was done from about people who are, you know, voters in the early voting states in the presidential race, and they're saying that it's one in two voters have personally experienced and the impact of global climate change. Of course, it's probably two out of two. it's probably everybody, but one in two recognizes that they've experienced an extreme weather situation that they attributed to the global warming. So I think the awareness is definitely way up than it was, I think, even 5 or 10 years ago. But unfortunately, our current political leadership is kind of head in the sand and stuck and not responding the way, you know, Obama at least began to do it, but that became stalled and reversed with the current administration and the Republicans controlling the Senate. So there, that leaves room for the states and the cities to take action, which, of course, they are. And so many, California, other states, really kind of taking the lead in doing what they can do at a state level. So you very smartly chose the state of Maryland as the place to lay out an actual, really detailed plan of what Maryland can do to respond to the climate crisis. Could you kind of just start with some of the headlines, and then we'll go into more detail about each of the aspects of your plan?
Yeah, so the big headline is, technically, we have the technology to go to almost fully renewable energy. We can do it smartly. The economic headline is that it will be as economical and probably more economical. In other words, we'll save money if we go to renewable energy compared to business as usual. That's without counting the costs of climate damage and the avoided, you know, intensity of floods and fires and so on. Not counting the cost of carbon, and I am not actually an advocate of putting a tax on carbon in order to incentivize people. I think we need good, strong targets and regulations and a roadmap, and like renewable portfolio standards and so on, and I think we can get there. So the economic and technical headline is we can do it and we will save money. The subsidiary headline is, of course, there are a lot of people involved in the fossil fuel industry, where coal-fired generating plants are, the oil industry. I think we need to proactively create new living wage, good jobs in those communities. We can't wait to see what happened in, like, eastern Kentucky and West Virginia for the coal industry to collapse and then communities to suffer and then say, oh, we need to do something. I think we need to do things proactively. I mean, there are people in Texas who are going from the oil industry into the wind and solar industries. It's happening in other places as well, but we need to do that much more intensively. So that's the electricity sector. But I think the other sectors, well, what about the transportation sector? What about buildings? We use natural gas for heating. And what about industry? So in those areas, the simple formula is to electrify everything. It's a little more complicated than that. You know, electrifying aircraft is not going to be an easy job, and you can do it direct, although NASA is actually, as we speak, building electric aircraft. And we know how to fuel aircraft with hydrogen instead of kerosene, hydrogen made from renewable energy. And, you know, hydrogen is flammable, of course, but as we know, kerosene is also flammable. Jet fuel is flammable. So if you're going to fly, you might have to, you know, it's one flammable fuel versus another. Of course, safety is important, but we need to, I think overall in almost every sector, we have the technology. It's a question of what policies are we going to, let me give you an example. So we heat with natural gas. Natural gas is currently pretty cheap, but we can heat with heat pumps. I have a geothermal heat pump in my house, and my energy footprint in my house has gone down from about 160 million BTU a year to 40, 50 million BTU a year, simply by having some solar on my rooftop and having a geothermal heat pump and, you know, doing some insulation and efficiency measures, but not going to extreme expensive measures in a relatively old house. So I think buildings need to be transformed to electricity. A lot of buildings, especially in the east, mid-Atlantic and northeast, use oil for heating and propane for heating. Oil and propane are definitely more expensive than using heat pumps. And when your heating system goes out, that's a good time to replace it. Now, public policy needs to make that possible. So New York State, as you were mentioning, states are taking the lead. So New York State has a renewable heating program where they are setting forth to convert buildings to renewable energy, mainly electricity derived from renewable sources. And over a period of 20, 30, 40 years, they will be able to construct or revamp existing buildings to be very efficient. We also know how to build new buildings so they are carbon neutral. In other words, you're generating solar energy on your rooftop and you're making your building very efficient. And so your net emissions from what electricity you buy and what electricity you sell over a year will be zero. Now, is that very expensive? No, because efficient buildings are now economical. Overall, it would save money, but we have to have the rules. The builder doesn't have any incentive to put $10 more to build your house. If he can build it for $100 and sell it to you for $100, he may have a quicker sale. But if he builds it for $110 and you save money on your mortgage plus your energy bill, that's a good deal for the buyer. But the builder won't do it by themselves because they fear losing to the competition, you know, that might have a cheaper house. So that's why we need sensible regulations. California, for instance, will require starting next year that all houses have solar on their rooftop, new construction. And many states have or are thinking of regulations along similar lines. So we can take care of buildings and the electricity sector in reasonably straightforward ways. We can create lots of jobs. That's the other headline is right now we send a lot of energy money, even though we're producing more energy in the United States, we still import, I don't know, 4 or 5 million barrels of oil a day. We send a lot of money out of the country to buy energy. And what do we do with this oil? How efficiently do we use it? Well, I have some bad news for you. So we go to war for oil, as is commonly known. I mean, Alan Greenspan said the Iraq war was about oil. That's not an exact quote, but pretty close. Mm-hmm. Kissinger said the same thing. And so we get this oil. We have 100 units of energy. We spend 5 or 10 refining it and bringing it to the gas station. And you put it in your car, and then you lose 80 units of it in waste heat out the tailpipe. So out of 100 units of energy, you're only getting 15 or 20 at the wheels of the car. If you have an electric car, and now we do have electric cars, so we can measure and compare, you have 100 units of energy at the plug, and you get 80 units at the wheels of the car. So you're quadrupling the efficiency. And if you produce it with renewable energy, of course, let me give you a more dramatic example of how badly we do things today. We use 30 million acres, more than 30 million acres, to grow corn to produce ethanol, mostly for 10% of automotive fuel, just 10%. If you put solar panels as a thought experiment on all that land, you could have two and a half to three times as much electricity as we use for everything. So we are actually polluting the water, wasting money, wasting energy, and really using up land in ways that are very inappropriate to produce energy very inefficiently. I'm not saying we should put solar panels on all that particular land. You don't want to use agricultural land that way. It's just an example of how badly we're doing things and how much more efficient and better and economical it will be if we made a determined bid. So how do we get there? That's the main question. We can do it, but how do we get there?
Right, exactly. How do we get there? And I love your focus both on the cutting the waste side or increasing the efficiency, and then also shifting from the fossil fuels and even nuclear over to renewable energy. Just on that question, in terms of how, you know, a sense of scale, how important is it in terms of increasing efficiency, and how important is it on the shifting to renewables? Do you have a sense of that?
They're about equally important. And we have a historical example. I mean, I started working on energy in the early 70s. And at the time, it was thought that by the end of the century, we would be using roughly twice as much energy as we were in the early 70s. And I worked for the Energy Policy Project of the Ford Foundation. And we thought we could do things much more efficiently, and maybe we wouldn't have any energy growth with the same economic growth, or very little energy growth with the same economic growth. And we did have energy efficiency policies. Really, President Carter's energy policies are still benefiting us today, like appliance standards and refrigerator standards and cafe standards for cars and so on. And instead of doubling from 70 quads of energy 250 or 200 quads of energy. Today, 50 years later, we're using less than 100 quads of energy. So our energy growth went from 3% a year to less than 1% a year. And our electricity growth also declined, and the economic growth has been about the same. And if it's a little bit less, it's not for energy reasons at all. So we still have a lot of scope for saving energy, as I illustrated with cars. It's the same in buildings. It's the same with heat pumps and heating. Not all sectors have the same potential, but we can save a lot. We can save about two-thirds of the energy we use. So my Maryland calculation showed that you could double the size of the economy and eliminate 60% of the primary energy use if we went to solar and wind energy. And a lot of that saving comes from vehicles, and a lot comes from electricity. Today, two-thirds of the fuel, coal, nuclear fuel, is discharged as waste heat at the power plant. It goes just to heat water, which is discharged into rivers and lakes and oceans. Only one-third is put in the wires, and about 90% of that winds up in your house and my house. So 30% efficiency. And, of course, then we don't use it very efficiently at the using end. So we go to solar and wind, we eliminate that two-thirds that is waste heat. And one of the huge advantages is that we eliminate one of the largest uses of fresh water in the United States for cooling power plants. So we will have a lot more water supply. We'll have a lot more room for both restoring ecosystems and in places also for development. Here in the Maryland, Pennsylvania, Delaware region, development is limited by fresh water. but most of the fresh water is used to cool power plants.
Fascinating. So let's go a little bit deeper in this, and I know not everybody lives in Maryland, but I think it's such a great case study, and what you're talking about in Maryland, it seems to me, can really provide a great model for what could be done nationally when we get some better, more enlightened leadership there. But let's talk about on this efficiency. I'm not sure. I'm hearing you right. This is stunning to me. You're saying that of the on the efficiency question, that we could save two-thirds of the energy currently being used, that it's kind of wasted in the process of, like, generating the electricity or being used at the, on the other end. You saying we're wasting two-thirds of the energy we now have?
In electricity generation, we throw away two-thirds of it at the power plant, and then we throw away a lot more when we use it. So that's why I said, overall, if we go in solar and wind energy, you don't throw away, you know, when the sun shines on your solar panels, almost all of that electricity is useful energy. We lose some of it in the inverters and in the technical equipment needed to bring it to your house, even from the rooftop, but almost all of it is useful. And the same for wind energy. And we eliminate the use of water. It's the same with automobiles. It's the same with heating systems. Our heating systems are not very efficient because we can get free heat from the ground and the atmosphere if we use the right equipment. So the main problem, so the technical details are sometimes more complicated and wonky, but and you can certainly find all of them on the website of the Institute, IEER.org. The question is, what do we need to do to get it done? What do the states need to do? What do industries need to do? And what does the federal government need to do? What do corporations need to do? And what do we need to do as individuals? So those are the big questions, because currently states are doing things, cities are doing things, corporations are, but we're far from doing enough, and we're not pointed overall in the right direction.
Right, absolutely true. I was really struck on that energy efficiency statistic you use, because, as you know, I did some work for Boston Edison many years ago on energy efficiency, and I felt a little bit like Pogo when we looked around about, well, where could we save energy? I thought it was going to be like a tough slog. I was like, oh my God, we are surrounded by insurmountable opportunity. There is so much waste everywhere on the energy. Yeah. Just like pick one and start working at it. There's just tremendous room for increasing efficiencies. And as we know, when you're wasting energy, you're wasting money. And now we know also the impact on the climate. So we really want to, let's do everything that we can do around the efficiency. So a little bit now on the renewable side, we see, of course, solar and wind energy kind of coming up gangbusters. As you said, you know, 10 years ago, it looked like it was going to be a long time before the energy from solar or wind sources would be competitive. But now we have, like, the Republican mayor in a town in Texas saying, I'm for solar energy and renewable energy, not because I'm a tree-hugging liberal. I'm not. I'm a right-wing Republican. But I care about my taxpayers and my voters, and I don't want to waste their money. And at this moment, just in the market as it is, he found that the solar energy was cheaper than the old way of doing business, so he was shifting over to 100% renewables for his town. So talk to us a little bit about what's happening now with the technologies and the cost for renewables.
Yes. When people think about environment and energy, a lot of California comes to mind. But the most advanced states in wind energy is not California. It is Texas. And by a different metric, on a per-person basis, it is Iowa. And it is not happening in Texas and Iowa because of government mandate. It is happening because wind energy is the cheapest energy, electricity there is. So you need to be able to put it on the wires. You need to have the transmission So in Texas, the grid operator, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, and the government of Texas decided to create the corridors from West Texas, where there's plenty of wind and plenty of land and low population, to the population centers in central, you know, in the Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, Houston corridor. And so they've had a boom in wind energy, and now they are going to have a boom in solar energy as well. Iowa has, I think, 40% of its electricity use is wind energy. Not its use overall, its generation, 40% is wind. I think, so Maryland actually is a very middling state in terms of the quality of its renewable resources. Most states in the Midwest have much, much better resources. And then in the Southwest and the West, they have even better resources because many states like Texas, New Mexico, California, they have both wind energy and solar energy. And the combination is actually very useful because, of course, the sun by definition doesn't shine at night, but the wind does blow at night. So when you combine them properly, you reduce the requirements for energy storage, and so you reduce the costs. But if we go to solar and wind, we will also need a smart grid. Every consumer can become a producer of energy, like I am. I'm a producer and a consumer of energy. And there are now, I think, millions of producers and consumers of energy in the United States. And we need to go in that direction, not only because it's economical, but distributed energy, smaller scale, combined with bigger scale, will be more resilient as we have more disruptive events. If we have more local generation, if they had more local generation in Puerto Rico, they would have not had such extended disruption of their electricity grid after Hurricane Maria as they did. And I think they are thinking of going in that direction in Puerto Rico, and we should throughout the country. Let's step back a little bit about what we need to do. So in the electricity sector is actually the least difficult because we have the technology, we have wind and solar, they're economical. And it's a state sector area because Public Utility Commission policies and states can set renewable energy policy. And I think we can have set mandates for renewable energy 100% by 2035 or 2040. It is a reasonable and cost-effective thing to do. I've done the numbers. You can find them on our website. I helped write the technical parameters for 100% renewable energy electricity by 2035 for Maryland. That was considered last year. It didn't pass, unfortunately, but, you know, it's out there in the public arena.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simplest sector. We can act, and that's the sector in which states need to step up. But the federal government can arrange, make it easier for them. The grid operators, the interstate grid operators can make it easier by having the right rules for people to be able to feed electricity into the grid. Of course, the federal government can make its own purchasing decisions. It's a huge consumer of every type of energy, and if it makes the right purchasing decisions, it can affect the electricity market immensely. But electricity, we can go ahead, it's the simplest. Similarly, in buildings, we need to have new buildings be carbon neutral, have renewable generation, and be extremely efficient. And we can do that now. The only delay is how long does it take to acquire the political spine to get it done. So those are the two of the largest sectors. The biggest and most difficult sector currently is transportation. Electric vehicles are not 100% economical yet. They're the most efficient. I think they're probably also safer in most ways. You're not carrying a huge amount of gasoline around in your car. And by the way, the market and the battery market is developing, battery technology is developing, and what is being done in many places around the world, we should have a target of banning the sale of petroleum vehicles by 2035 or 2040. In Norway, they're going to do it in 2025. France has a 2040 target. So somewhere in that range, to give a huge industry the signal that we are going to shift this technology, it's completely possible. We have shifted technology on that scale. I think we went from horses to cars in 20 years. So we can go from cars to cars, one type of car to another type of car in 20 years. I think if we send the right signals. Of course, the federal and state governments can also purchase these vehicles. Shenzhen in China already, I think, has 100% electric buses or will soon have 100% electric buses. Many cities, as you were mentioning, are leaders in this area. They are transitioning, but not enough. We have two electric bus manufacturing companies, factories in the United States, maybe more than two, but two that I know about. This market needs to increase. We need to increase public transit. We need to have much more investment in affordable public transit than we do, and that public transit should be electric. Diesel pollution, besides climate, is killing people today. Respiratory diseases are all too common, especially in more vulnerable communities. This is a problem we can deal with while dealing with climate. In some ways, the most difficult sector is aircraft, and we've talked about this informally, you and I, Eleanor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think we need to have a big push for, much bigger than what we're doing now, for hydrogen aircraft, hybrid aircraft, fuel cell aircraft, and electric aircraft. All of these types are possible. They are being developed. But I think the push is nowhere near the scale it needs to be. My proposal is for Wichita, Kansas, which has been I had hoped that President Obama, being from Kansas, would do it. His grandparents mm-hmm. were from there.
Right.
That he would create a great center for aircraft research in Wichita, which is historically an aircraft manufacturing airline industry-centered city, but it didn't happen. It can still happen. There are lots of them. There's South Carolina, there's Los Angeles, there's Seattle, there's Wichita, or maybe right here in Maryland where we have the headquarters of NASA, which is very familiar with hydrogen. So we can do this. As I said, we need to grow the spine, and we haven't yet.
Yeah, well, you've laid out a great set of actions there, and picking up on what you're saying about public transportation, that's an area that my husband works in full-time, as you know, and
yeah.
He runs a nonprofit that's focused on public transportation. He told me the other day, so, well, on the scale like of how people move from one place to another, what's the percentage of that movement that is done on public transportation, like buses or trains? And he said it's about 2%.
Yeah,
said,
very pathetically
small. Oh, my God.
Small.
We have so much room for growth. I mean,
yeah.
We could quadruple the capacity for public transit, particularly in the cities, moving people around without all these cars. And the congestion downtown has gotten so awful. I mean, some cities are now doing the downtown fee if you're in downtown central city in rush hour, you have to pay a particular kind of like a congestion fee. So why not, really do massive input into trains and buses and monorails and all kinds of way of dramatically increasing, expanding our public transportation. That would really help people get out of their cars, whatever kind of cars they are, and reduce our carbon emissions.
Your husband probably knows this much better than I do, Eleanor, but since he's not on the radio, let me say this. We think about public transport backwards. we think, you know, we have to recover all the revenues from public transport, and we keep raising the fares, and the ridership keeps going down, and make it more difficult for people to use public transit. And then of course, it becomes less frequent and less usable and less convenient, and that makes it more. So you have a negative spiral, and we have had a negative spiral of public transit in so many places over the last decade. When I wrote Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, I was shocked to find that the efficiency of public transit was going down because the ridership was going down. And ridership goes down, then the fares increase. That's not the right way to think about it. The right way to think about it is to think about public transit as an essential part of the infrastructure of urban areas the way we do water and sewage. We don't ask, you know, or post, you know, we don't charge people more in suburbia because it takes the postman longer to deliver mail to every single detached house than it does to apartment buildings. It is an essential service like water, sewer, and so on that we provide, you know, to a large extent at a fixed cost. The fixed connection cost to the electricity grid, the fixed connection cost to the gas grid, and so on. And we need to think in the same way for public transit. It should be safe, it should be frequent, it should be affordable, and it should be dense. That is, you know, you should have enough of a network that it's, in Paris, you're never more than 5 minutes walk away from a metro station. Sometimes it takes longer underground to get out of the station.
Right.
Than it does once you're at street level to go to where you're going because the station network is so dense. Now, you know, we can't build an underground network in most cities the way it is in Paris, but you can do bus rapid transit. You can do it in many different ways. How are we going to? And in Paris, it's much more affordable than it is here in Washington or San Francisco. How do they do it? I haven't studied it all, but you know, the real estate values go up along public transit routes, especially attractive ones. And all of that profit goes to private parties that develop the real estate. Well, some of it came out of public investment in the transit, so some of it should be plowed back into transit. We need to be able to help people who live near public transit routes stay in their homes when public transit makes neighborhoods more attractive. In other words, the people who are there now can be part of the gentrification process in the sense of being able to stay in their homes and acquire some of the value of their property increase. Or if they're renters, you know, we have to find other ways to enable them to stay in their homes. We can have a massive, massive investment in public transit and also in intercity transit, but I think we need to think about it differently. Also think, you know, that bus rapid transit can be part of the route to getting to more dense train networks. Once ridership goes up, then it becomes more economical to build a rail. But until then, you know, it's much cheaper and faster to go bus. So, and, you know, maybe you ought to have Jack on the show to elaborate.
That's a great idea. I'll do that sometime.
Yeah. I'm promoting your husband's business here, but it's fair since I'm doing it and not you.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm wondering now, with all these great and good ideas you've laid out, if you were advising the next president, and hopefully the next president will be elected in 2020, what are the top three things you would want that president to do?
Well, I would set a goal of 60% greenhouse gas reductions by 2030 and ask the Department of Energy to come up with a plan to get that done within 12 months. And the role of the federal government and what the federal government needs to do to help states, local governments, corporations, and individuals and the policies that we need. A lot of that landscape is already clear from things that have happened at the state level, but it has never been brought together in a policy of the public. So 60% greenhouse gas reduction, that's across other sectors as well, and 100% carbon neutral by 2045. So that's the overall sort of policy landscape. The second thing I would do is I would advise to radically change the perspective on federal purchasing. The federal government spends a lot of money, and state and local governments spend even more money. I mean, so the federal government in its own purchasing and its relations with states to encourage states to have the right purchase, to create the market for the right kinds of things, for heat pumps, for electric vehicles, and so on. And the third area, I would say, is a massive transformation of the public transit arena. There are other areas that are not energy-related in agriculture that should also be done as a complement. They're part of the Green New Deal document, you know, that we should have regenerative agriculture and healthy soils, and that's where you absorb some of the carbon dioxide we've already emitted. But that's a topic, you know, for a future conversation, but it's something that needs to be done in parallel. If I might say, you know, this, I think the industrial sector is a difficult sector, and I think we should set up a national laboratory for materials for agriculture and industry. Let me say that again. The National Laboratory for Agricultural and Industrial Sustainability. That's a mouthful. But mm-hmm. we have the National Renewable Energy Lab that we've had for many years, for decades. It was started under Carter as the Solar Energy Research Institute. And it's done wonders. It's been in the middle of the renewable energy transformation that we can now benefit from, that we are benefiting from. We haven't had anything like that in materials, and something that could join agriculture and industry and create a lot of good jobs. We need to think through the way we do materials in industry and the way we do agriculture. So that I would put very high on the research agenda.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I was impressed in reviewing your plan for Maryland that you actually found, you know, that there would be jobs created in doing this. I know it's been a big way for some skeptics to attack all the work done on a Green New Deal or dealing with the climate change, is to say, well, look at all the jobs you're going to lose in the coal industry and the oil industry. So yes, you'll create some in renewables, but it won't be as much as you're going to lose. That's actually completely false. And there's so many more jobs already in renewables compared to coal is just stunning. But talk a little bit about what you found with your in-depth research on Maryland in terms of job creation versus job loss.
Yeah, so we have, in Maryland, we only have about, apart from the gas stations and so on and the distributed urban infrastructure, where the real estate, where the gas station is often more valuable than the gas station itself, we have about 2,000 jobs in the electric generating sector that could be displaced if we went completely to renewable energy. And we have a few hundred jobs in coal mining. And the number of jobs that will be created by going to a smart grid and replacing our natural gas and oil heat with heat pumps and so on is far larger than that. And where the economic equation works out is, as a state, we send about half of the money we spend on energy to other states and abroad, Mexico, Canada, Saudi Arabia, wherever. And if we spent many more of those dollars at home within the state, we're, of course, going to be creating that many more jobs. We also create a lot more jobs making energy use much more efficient, as we've already discussed. So when you add it all up, you're spending slightly less money on the overall energy sector than before, and you're spending more of it close to home. When you spend less money, when you save, when you have more dollars to spend, of course, that becomes an economic stimulus. So now you're, instead of spending $100 on energy, you're spending $80. So you spend the other $20 on other things, or you save it and invest it. So that creates more jobs. And that's where the how the economic system hums, is when there's basically more value for the dollar that you've been spending far away from home by spending it closer to home and doing it more productively. But it's not a slam dunk. Yeah, we have to be honest that in the areas where these power plants are, they're often rural areas in small communities. Those communities will be impacted. And I advocated in my research that we should devote tax revenues. In Minnesota, they tax large wind farms and they tax large solar energy installations, and they give all that money to the counties to spend. And wind energy is actually saving schools and main streets in small towns in Minnesota. You never imagine that, but it is. I actually interviewed the former Secretary of Agriculture in the state, who's a farmer in southwestern Minnesota, and he said, yes, over here, wind energy is saving rural America. So I think we need to devote some serious thought to what many labor advocates call a just transition, but by proactively creating infrastructure and jobs and making sure that the community has enough tax revenues in the way that I've just described to keep the police departments and fire departments and schools and libraries operating. The way we do things now, any large industry decides to shut down. And I think this is beyond just the energy industry. I think it's scandalous that some large industries come to town, we give them huge amounts of money, we don't ask them any guarantees for how long they're going to stay. They create jobs, and then they close down and take their shop someplace else and cause a local economic collapse. That's a pretty bad formula, I think, overall. At least there should be some provision for communities to be able to keep their schools and police departments and fire departments going if some big industry decides to shut down. In this case, we're talking about power plants, but it could apply to any industry.
Yeah, that's really important to pay attention to. So we see overall that there's a net job gain, and we want to be sensitive to certain communities where it's going to have a negative impact and deal with those. But overall, it's a net job gain. The other attack that's often launched against a version of a Green New Deal or helping address the climate change problems is the cost. And people say, oh, you want to do all this massive work, that's a massive bill, and we can't afford it. You've already mentioned one thing, which is the massive costs we're already paying from the damage from these extreme weather conditions. So there's that to consider. But your plan, when I saw it, I was like, all the great stuff you're doing on energy efficiency, on focusing on renewables, all of that, that ultimately, I thought, oh my God, it's going to be a big price tag. No, that your plan actually saves money, and it saves big money. For Maryland, it would be saving money to the tune of $1 to $7 billion a year. How is it that your plan saves money?
Well, it saves money because when you put efficiency and renewable energy and switching away from oil and transportation together, the dollars add up to less dollars than what we're spending now. The question is not whether it costs more. It won't. The question is the investment dollars today are controlled by oil and gas companies, and they are not being invested in the right place. So that's where public policy comes in. Is we need to basically have a public investment and public policy that would direct private investment away from fossil fuels and into renewable energy and efficiency. Without public policy, that is not going to happen. Even if these investments in oil and gas collapse for the fossil fuel sector, it's not necessary that they're going to have the vision to prevent their own collapse. They start collapsing, then they're going to come, as many industries do, to the taxpayer and say, bail us out, as the banks did 10 years ago. So, you know, for the rich, they're always too big to fail, and we're always doling out dollars to them. And that's a formula that works for them. We have to have public policies that make sure that they get the message that that formula is not going to work for them. First of all, we have to stop building all this infrastructure around fossil fuels with natural gas pipelines and encouraging fracking and so on. So there's a role for public policy to achieve this economy. We need to redirect the dollars that are being invested in fossil fuel and fossil fuel infrastructure in renewable energy. Otherwise, we can't make it happen. And that's where basically the partnership between government and corporations and so on. And insurance companies realize that, you know, they're going to be in for hard times in a shrinking market for insurance, because a lot of places are going to become uninsurable. So it's not that all private corporations aren't open to what we're talking about. There are many that are open. There are many that are buying renewable energy. They just haven't been gathered up together into a coherent stream that will flow in one direction and kind of get us to a clean future.
That's great. And we just have 1 minute to go here. Have you had a chance to look at any of the candidates for president? Like Governor Inslee is making this the cornerstone of his campaign for president. Do you think he's got a good program, or what do you see that's out there that's worthwhile, if anything, right now?
Yeah, well, you know, I think Governor Inslee's program is reasonably good. You know, I think it could be better. I think, you know, we have to deal with this problem of nuclear energy. The nuclear energy is too expensive to help with the transition to a carbon-free future. We have to deal with that and let go of a 20th century technology. But we do have nearly 100 nuclear power plants, and we have to decide, you know, how long they're going to be operating and whether we should be subsidizing. In my calculation, you know, they can operate for as long as they're considered safe, but we shouldn't be subsidizing them because we can buy wind energy cheaper than subsidizing what New York and New Jersey are doing today to subsidize their nuclear plants.
Fantastic. So I think, Dr. Arjun Makhijani, thank you so much for all your great work.
Thank you, Eleanor, for having me on your show.
People are talking.